The political drama between Arizona's schools chief and the State Board of Education has turned into a legal drama. The board disputes Diane Douglas's lawsuit, but her attorney's not backing down.
They're sticking by, you know, what they allege in the lawsuit, and I think his exact words were, the law's on our side.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Also today on the show, Arizona's evolution on dealing with and prosecuting sex trafficking. Several states are getting federal money to compensate for the drought, but Arizona isn't one of them.
And are Glendale and the Coyotes ready to drop the gloves again?
So overall, you have what appears to be some bad blood spilling out into the public, whereas much of the stuff in the past has remained either behind closed doors or has been on a much lower key level than what we have now.
Plus, lather up and millions of peaches, peaches for us.
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein along with Mark Brody. Cloudy skies across most of the valley right now. We expect mostly clear skies by tonight with lows in the mid-60s. Should be partly to mostly sunny tomorrow and quite a bit cooler with just a high of 83. Then look for a high of 85 degrees for Saturday. Currently, it's partly cloudy and 89 degrees. In Valley traffic, there's an accident on the 101 southbound in the East Valley just south of Shea, which is causing a little bit of a backup.
Arizona's seasonally adjusted unemployment rate for April dropped slightly, down 0.2% to 6%. The State Department of Administration says Arizona's economy gained 2,200 non-farm jobs last month. Seven of the 11 sectors the state tracks added jobs, with four reporting losses in April. Analysts say professional and business services added 3,300 jobs, with government adding 1,900 and construction 1,300 jobs last month. They say trade, transportation, and utilities lost 4,200 jobs in April, while manufacturing, the sector shed 1,400 jobs. The national unemployment rate dropped 0.1 point last month to 5.4%.
The Oak Tree brush fire burning 10 miles north of Sonoyta in southern Arizona has already burned 2,000 acres and is 20% contained. Michelle Fidler is a public information officer with the National Park Service. She says good progress is being made, but
we do have concern with the increasing winds. We may still see some heat within the interior of the unit. So our firefighters are going to be out there again today, working to monitor, patrol, strengthen our fire lines to help secure the fire and make sure that we're able to fully suppress it.
The nearest structures are a few miles northeast of the fire. Fidler says crews have conducted burnout operations to help protect them. The fire is human-caused and currently under investigation.
Authorities say a 16-year-old boy has been detained for allegedly making a hit list of more than two dozen students and teachers he wanted to harm at his Phoenix high school. Phoenix police say a parent notified officials at Shadow Mountain High School this morning. They say the unidentified boy didn't have any weapons on him when he went to school. His motive for the alleged threats isn't immediately clear. Police say the teen's threats included creating his own bacteria to which he would be immune. But the school's principal says there were valid concerns for the students and staff. The legal dispute between State School Superintendent Diane Douglas and the Arizona Board of Education made it into the courtroom this morning. Douglas has filed suit asking a judge to rule she controls the board's employees and that they have to come back to work at the Education Department. They'd moved into the Executive Tower a few weeks ago. Arizona Capital Times reporter Gary Grotto was at this morning's hearing. And Gary, what happened?
This just was an initial proceeding where the attorneys kind of lay out their proposed schedule for the case and, you know, let the judge know some of the motions they're going to file, some of the issues that they think are important, that sort of stuff. And what happened was the judge set a June 26th date where they're going to have oral arguments on the defendant's motion to dismiss. Now, they haven't filed that yet, but they intend to, and that's when they're going to hear that motion.
And this is all over the issue of basically, who does the Board of Education staff report to, right? The board or the superintendent?
Exactly. And Douglas also wants, you know, a court order that they return to their offices at the Department of Education because they moved out, I think it was May 9th, to the Executive Tower.
Did you get any kind of sense this morning from the attorneys what the arguments might look like when they come up next month?
Yeah, you know, the board's attorney was saying that, you know, this case is, you know, has a lot of factual disputes and, you know, a lot of legal disputes. You know, they're disputing some of the things that were in the lawsuit. for instance, that the board employees are not listening to her or following her direction. And, you know, they're saying that in turn that Douglas is creating a hostile work environment for them. And so those are, you know, some of the facts that are at dispute. And, you know, of course, there's the legal dispute over the, you know, the wording of the statute or the interpretation of the statute, which is somewhat ambiguous on who the employees really report to.
Well, that was the subject of a bill that was in the legislature. There was some effort to try to make that a little more clear. Do you get the sense that this is the kind of issue that the judge would want to weigh in on, as opposed to letting lawmakers figure this out?
Well, that's, you know, one of the arguments of the board. They're saying that this is, you know, a political issue, and this is something the court probably should not be weighing in on, should not be deciding.
What did you hear from Diane Douglas's attorneys today? I mean, what kinds of arguments might we expect to hear from them when the actual oral arguments start?
Well, they're sticking by, you know, what they allege in the lawsuit, and I think his exact words were, the law's on our side, and they don't think that the judge is going to need to, you know, set trial or, you know, go through the full-blown motions of, you know, trial, you know, depositions and motions and all that sort of stuff, and he thinks that, you know, she should be able to rule on a summary judgment.
Reporter Gary Grotto with the Arizona Capital Times. He covered this morning's hearing in court between the State Board of Education and Superintendent of Public Instruction, Diane Douglas. Gary, thanks.
Hey, thanks a lot, Mark.
The issue of sex trafficking in Arizona started receiving a lot of attention among the broader public earlier this year when the Valley hosted the Super Bowl. That started conversations about how to lessen demand and how to help underage people who were being exploited. Today in Phoenix, the Arizona Next Steps Summit was held to create and expand strategies for fighting trafficking. Linda Smith is the president and founder of Shared Hope International, which did extensive research on the subject in Arizona.
There is more activity here than most of the nation. Yes, trafficking is active here. But the law enforcement, the collaboration, the civil society have been very active here in trying to change laws, which they have, and trying to get those laws enforced. So we did, I guess you could say, a targeted research project, and we went and interviewed people in the judicial system, prosecutors, law enforcement, and child protective services to find out what their perception was of trafficking, but also to find out what they thought was working and what they thought we needed to do next. There is movement all over the state, and some of it started within the last 24 months, but there is a harmony happening in calling for justice now under the strengthened laws for those that would shop for the innocence of children in Arizona. That's the good part.
Okay. Yes, please tell us what some of the continuing challenges are.
Some of what we found were prosecutors concerned that they couldn't even get a jury because society, in general, is still looking at the girl as a prostitute, a criminal, and they look at the buyer as just kind of a, not a wise guy doing it, but just a guy. And if they sit there in the jury stand and they perceive the crime that way, you're not going to get 100% of the jury. So some of the prosecutors, some of the players said, we're just not sure we can get a jury. Others countered that and said, we think we can get a jury now. We think the public understand. And we think now we can start prosecuting more effectively. So what we found there was an emerging mindset, and it was all coming up from we don't know to we think we can, and in some cases they are absolutely running additional stings and they're going after the buyers and they're assuring that there is a high risk in Arizona. What we want is people that come to Arizona to know clearly, or men. And 99% of our research shows us the buyers are 99% men. We want them to go, we're terrified. We're not going into that area. Because if we happen to get a child, there's zero tolerance.
How much can Arizona do on its own, and how much does it need help from international and national organizations?
I don't think international and national organizations are the answer. I think it is Arizona. We've analyzed Arizona's law now for 5 years and done a report card on it. It went from a very low grade, I think it started with a D, to a B. That's the action of people here. That's when we literally work together to inform our legislators. The prosecution is elected locally. The prosecutors are elected locally. The police are all local. 95% of the law enforcement in the United States is done by local jurisdictions. It isn't done by the federal government. The federal law is strong, but the reality is we here, that are just pretty ordinary people, we are the ones that make the difference.
Linda Smith, president and founder of Shared Hope International. Another off-season and more talk of the Phoenix, Arizona Coyotes, rather. Ownership is making plans to move the team out of the Valley. A recent column by Brendan Porter of the Five for Howling blog on SB Nation fleshes that out by focusing on a conflict on payments between the Coyotes and the city of Glendale.
So certain members of the city of Glendale, city council, are dissatisfied with the lease agreement that the council agreed to with ICE Arizona back in 2013. And there are at least one council member, Ian Hugh, who has gone on the record as saying he believes ICE Arizona is in breach of contract of that lease agreement. The Coyotes have obviously pushed back very hard against this assertion, saying that they're still in full compliance with the agreement as they signed back in 2013. But it's yet another issue that's come up in a process that seemed to have gone on for 5 or 6 years now.
Does anything seem sketchy about this? I mean, is there a reason for this, or is the city of Glendale just sort of feeling like, well, here we go again, and so there's just sort of anger based on the amount of money that's been allocated?
I think that one of the biggest issues is that you've had a lot of turnover since 2014, the last city council election, where the voting majority that voted for the agreement has largely either retired or has left office, and you now only have a couple that are still on the council. And some of the individuals who are on the council still carrying over from that agreement were ones that voted against the original agreement. So you have some lingering dissatisfaction there, I believe. And then since the Coyotes ownership group was subsumed more or less by Andrew Barroway back in 2014, you have this dynamic where the players that the city originally talked to in 2013 have changed somewhat. And reportedly, Barroway has yet to meet with the current city council. So there might be some lingering unhappiness with that in general, and then you have some dissatisfaction with the amount of money that Glendale is spending. So overall, you have what appears to be some bad blood spilling out into the public, whereas much of the stuff in the past has remained either behind closed doors or has been on a much lower key level than what we have now.
If you were to interpret this, does this have anything to do with a government entity looks at some of the ownership? I mean, look at Andrew Barroway, what he probably has in the bank and his investments. Think, well, couldn't they sort of do something different that would allow Glendale to, I don't want to say get off the hook, but not have to make these payments? Does any of that sort of come up into this sort of the perspective of who Barroway is? Maybe he thinks he's above the fray, that kind of thing.
I think that's definitely part of it. Glendale explicitly wants to be a partner in this relationship more than it wants to be sort of an ancillary factor because of how much they're contributing to the management of the arena. So when you have a guy like Barroway who is, you know, not necessarily based in Arizona, he lives out back east in the Philadelphia area, last I know. You have other members of the ownership group who are from Calgary or from other parts of North America. You have a lot of this perception of these outsiders who don't really know the city, aren't really there every day. And so Glendale saying, if we're putting up, you know, $15 million a year for you guys to manage the arena, we want to be a partner in this as well. And sort of this perceived slight can probably create some unhappiness with the city council.
Are you seeing a path that leads to this being a factor in the Coyotes leaving, or is that just more sort of pot stirring?
I think it's more pot stirring than anything else. If you look at the way the Coyotes have managed the arena and the way that the team's loss figures have decreased over the past couple of years, it looks like they're trying to make a legitimate shot out of staying in Arizona. It doesn't necessarily mean they're going to stay in Arizona. It's indeed possible that they relocate after the 5 years when they have this window to relocate. But it certainly seems like if that's going to happen, it's not because there is some grand plan from the very beginning to make this happen.
Brendan Porter, managing editor of the Five for Howling blog, the Arizona Coyotes blog on SB Nation.
Still to come, the food industry has been regulating itself when it comes to marketing healthy food to kids, and there's some disagreement as to how it's doing.
The Federal Trade Commission, which extensively studies food marketing to children, has commended the progress that's being made under self-regulation.
The problem with this commitment is they have a very generous definition of what qualifies as a healthy food.
We'll sort it out ahead. It's the show.
Good afternoon, 219. You're listening to the show on KJZZ with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. Not much going on in Valley traffic this afternoon. We're not seeing any accidents or heavy slowing on the freeways. Valley weather, the clouds should stay with us through the rest of the afternoon. Then we'll have clearing tonight with lows expected to be in the mid-60s. Should be partly to mostly sunny tomorrow and way below normal with a high of 83. Similar conditions for Saturday with a high of 85. Currently, relative humidity is at 11%. Partly cloudy, 89 degrees at KJZZ.
KJZZ is supported by the Children's Museum of Phoenix, featuring summer camps immersed in art, science, dramatic play, and literature exploration. More about summer camps at childrensmuseumofphoenix.org.
It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. The first batch of thousands of emails that Hillary Clinton sent through a private email address while serving as Secretary of State have been obtained by the New York Times. It's well ahead of the State Department's scheduled first release date of January 2016. With more on this, here's our partner Todd Zwillick at The Takeaway.
Now, both the media and Clinton have requested the messages be made public, and so far, they appear to contain sensitive but not classified information, largely from around the time of the attacks in Benghazi. And, of course, those attacks and their aftermath are the subject of an intense investigation in Congress by an ongoing special committee. For more now, we go to Michael Schmidt, reporter for our partner, The New York Times. Welcome, Michael.
Hi, thank you for having me.
What do these emails show about what was known about the attacks on the compound by Hillary Clinton in Benghazi around that time and in its immediate aftermath? Are we learning anything new?
What we're learning is that Hillary Clinton was receiving sort of intelligence-like cables from a longtime confidant named Sidney Blumenthal, who had been prevented from joining her at the State Department. And he was providing her with his account of what occurred in the attacks, and she was circulating his accounts to others in the State Department. The interesting thing is that some of his accounts actually contradicted what the administration said really happened at the time.
In what ways do they contradict what the White House was saying, the Obama White House?
Well, the White House came out and said that it was not a pre-planned attack and it was a spontaneous outgrowth of this protest, but Mr. Blumenthal sent Mrs. Clinton a very detailed memo 2 days after the attacks that said indeed it had been a terrorist attack planned by this group from Eastern Libya, and she circulated that to her inside the State Department and said, get this around ASAP.
Now, the role of Sidney Blumenthal is a newish development as well. He has been subpoenaed by the special committee investigating Benghazi on Capitol Hill. He'll testify eventually. His relationship with the Clintons is a long one. People may remember him from back in the first Clinton, the only Clinton administration we've had, the administration of President Bill Clinton, his role in the aftermath of the Monica Lewinsky scandal, longtime confidant and lawyer. But what was his role here? Why was Sidney Blumenthal sending memo after memo on national security matters, sensitive ones, from outside the administration to the Secretary of State?
We don't really know. People in power apparently get a lot of emails from different folks and friends giving them different tips about things. The Clinton campaign has said that she did not request any of this information. It was all unsolicited. But what was happening is that she received 25 of these memos from Mr. Blumenthal over a 2-year period of time. And they were very detailed and they were addressed directly to her. And he was providing her with information from intelligence sources that he had on the ground in Libya. So it wasn't simply just, oh, here, I heard this at a cocktail party, let me pass it around. It was a systematic sending of memos.
Is it surprising to people in the national security spheres that Sidney Blumenthal is apparently sourced inside the government in Libya, that he can update the Secretary of State in this way?
I think a lot of people that know Mr. Blumenthal from the first, from the Clinton White House back in the 90s are a bit surprised by this and didn't think of Mr. Blumenthal as someone that had a particular amount of expertise in Libya or foreign affairs.
And there is some skepticism to some of the accounts you can see from Secretary Clinton herself, where she says this sounds like a conspiracy theory or this one sounds thin, but not to all of them, only to a couple.
Correct. She had sort of a wide range of responses to them. Some of them she thought were dubious, and some of them she wanted to get into the hands of Chris Stevens, the United States ambassador in Libya, and into the hands of other senior State Department officials to get their reactions to it. She wanted some of them, as I said, circulated immediately. She wanted some of Mr. Blumenthal's advice passed to the White House. And she wanted a lot of the memos that he sent printed, and apparently that was because she could read them. She preferred to read things in a printed form.
We should remind people, Michael Schmidt, if they're not thinking about it already, that the emails that you're reporting on, indeed the ones that will be released by the State Department and are in the possession now of the Special Committee investigating Benghazi, are ones that she has essentially selected. She handed over many of the emails that were on her private server. The ones she deemed not worthy of public attention are gone.
Correct. Well, what happened was is that the state last year, she handed over 55,000 pages of emails to the State Department, and that was in response to a request from the State Department for all records that she had that may not be in the State Department's possession. She then said in after it came out that she had exclusively used a personal email account, that she deleted about another essentially 30,000 emails that were on the account that she didn't pertain to her time as Secretary of State.
So a selection of the emails are now becoming public emails that the State Department will eventually release. And there is an ongoing investigation still on Capitol Hill around Benghazi and the emails of former Secretary of State and presidential candidate Hillary Rodham Clinton. Michael Schmidt for our partner, The New York Times. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
That's The Takeaways, Todd Zwillick.
How healthy is the food advertised to kids? That question is the subject of a new report and some controversy. In the early 2000s, health officials identified childhood obesity as a public health threat and determined kids' exposure to unhealthy food advertising was a big contributing factor. That led the food industry to self-regulate itself in that area. Dale Kunkel, professor of communication at the U of A, was the lead investigator on the new study, which was funded by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation.
The food marketing industry has made a number of public commitments. They've acknowledged that they're contributing to the problem, and they've said we're going to be part of the solution. They've said we'll only advertise healthy foods to kids. The problem with this commitment is they have a very generous definition of what qualifies as a healthy food. So what I did is I examined two elements. One, is the industry doing what it promised? And the answer to that question is yes. So that's the good news. However, I've also used independent criteria that come from the National Institutes of Health. I've used a food rating framework that identifies foods as being either go, slow, or woe. And it's easy to figure out how that works. The woe food should be consumed only on very rare occasions. The problem is 4 out of 5 foods advertised to children are still in the poor nutritional category, the so-called woe foods. And that's a big issue. That means that most of the ads that children are seeing on television are foods that are going to put them at risk of obesity.
So is it as simple as just changing the definition of what's healthy or coming to some kind of agreement between health advocates and the food industry of what constitutes a healthy meal?
Well, I don't think so. I wish it were that simple. I believe that the food industry has a pretty serious economic self-interest here. Not my study, but many other nutritionists who examine this problem suggest that the food industry is reticent to remove a lot of the sugar and salt from their products simply because that contributes to people eating more of it. And so there's been a lot of political pressure put on the industry to push their reforms more actively, more aggressively, and they simply haven't responded to date. Self-regulation from the industry, it was begun about 5 to 6 years ago, and we've seen absolutely no movement.
So does that suggest to you then that if self-regulation isn't working, that the regulation needs to come from someone else?
Well, it not only suggests it, but the National Academy of Sciences, in a report they issued about 8 years ago, indicated their advice. They said if the industry could not solve this problem on its own, Congress should regulate to achieve that outcome. And the outcome they talked about was having a majority of the foods advertised to children be nutritionally healthy.
When you look at marketing to kids, I'm curious how much of it is on TV. I know your study looked at television, but are kids watching as much TV? Are they watching their shows on other types of devices instead of TV like so many other people are?
Children's eyes are moving to other screens, to iPads, to computers, online activity, and so forth. The same as everyone else in the population. In fact, kids often lead that shift. Food marketers are following right along. There have been slight reductions in the volume of food advertising on children's television, but at the same time, we're seeing major increases in online advertising of food products to kids. Most all of the major food companies, McDonald's, for example, the cereal manufacturers, now have websites that are uniquely designed for children. And so the children then go to those websites and they play advert games, where they're immersed in a product environment for maybe 30 minutes instead of 30 seconds.
Dale Kunkel is professor of communication at the University of Arizona and the lead investigator on the study dealing with media marketing for kids' foods. Dale, thank you so much.
It's my pleasure to join you.
For its part, the food industry says it's made a lot of progress since it started regulating itself. Elaine Kolisch is director of the Children's Food and Beverage Advertising Initiative at the Council of Better Business Bureaus.
We agree that the amount of food advertising to kids has been declining over the years. Our own analyses bear that out. But where we part company with Professor Kunkel is about the results. We think that the research tool, the evaluative tool he uses, Go, Slow, Whoa, is significantly flawed, and it makes the results virtually meaningless.
In what way are those flawed?
So this Go Slow Whoa weight rating category assigns foods into one of these three categories, and those categories and the way foods are assigned to those categories are not aligned with the Dietary Guidelines for Americans that USDA and HHS put out, and they're certainly not aligned with the fairly recent and highly regarded standards for foods served to kids in schools through the school breakfast program and the school lunch program.
So am I understanding correctly that your point is that the food that is being advertised to kids is healthier than what Professor Kunkel came up with in his study?
That is absolutely right. There have been very significant changes since this program launched in 2007, and the Federal Trade Commission, which extensively studies food marketing to children, has commended the progress that's being made under self-regulation.
Can you give me a few examples in which food that is being advertised to kids is healthier in your mind than what the study reflected?
Yes. So let me tell you, there have been two big buckets of changes. You know, one is some foods are no longer advertised to kids at all. So, for example, the five major candy companies no longer advertise directly to kids. So that's one big change. The other change is how foods themselves have actually gotten healthier. And cereals are a prime example of this. And in this study, under this Whoa Foods category, any cereal that is sweetened, i.e. pre-sweetened, is a Whoa Food. And that doesn't really make any sense. And it's not consistent with what the foods that are served in the school breakfast program look like.
Does the progress that you're referring to also incorporate advertising online, on mobile devices, in addition to on television?
Yes, it does. We often talk about television because it's still kids' favorite medium. So more money is spent on advertising to kids on television, and kids spend more of their time with television than any other medium, though that's changing, of course. But we, of course, do cover digital ads and mobile ads and print ads and radio ads.
One of the other things that the study looked at was this concept of websites that food companies have that's dedicated to kids, where kids can basically play games, you know, and being immersed in products, sometimes in the study's mind, not necessarily the healthiest ones. Is that something that is of concern to you?
Well, we require that if there is a child-directed website from one of our participants, that the foods featured on that website or in any of the games they feature be the healthier foods. Now, one thing is that sometimes the packaging and the names are the same, but what's inside the box has changed, and that's what's really important.
Do you think there's more work for your organization to do to improve further the way that foods are advertised to kids?
We think there's always room for improvement, and we're committed to being a dynamic program that takes a look at its standards from time to time. So next year, after the Dietary Guidelines for Americans, the 2015 version, is issued, we'll take a look at our nutrition standards and see if we need to change them in any way. But we're very pleased and proud of the progress that our participants have already made.
Elaine Kolisch is director of the Children's Food and Beverage Advertising Initiative. Elaine, thank you.
Thank you.
It's the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
Got it?
Oh, we're in this awesome peach grove. It's a little bit overcast, so it's nice. And there's just lush peaches hanging from the trees. They're perfectly ripe.
You want to put some in the box?
We're here nice and early. I think it's about 9 o'clock, and we have just free reign of all these beautiful peaches. I have two boxes full, so I will probably walk away with 20 pounds today.
There you go. And you have a great day. Thank you.
The store-bought peaches, they're okay. Nothing compares to a fresh-picked peach that's just ripe and juicy and just dribbles all down your chin.
This one right here?
No, that one.
Oh. This one?
Yeah.
That was Joe Bastek picking peaches with his family at Schneff Farms in Queen Creek. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix or just want to tell us we're getting a little mealy, send us a note. The show at KJZZ.org.
Coming up, if there's one thing this family passes down through generations, it's a fighting spirit.
I've been doing this all my life. I was training since I was 4 years old. My father, he's been in this business for 38 years.
That's ahead. It's the show.
Good afternoon. No headlocks in Valley traffic yet at this point. That's probably later during rush hour. One accident to tell you about, though. 101 northbound in the East Valley. It's at the Southern Avenue on-ramp, and that lane is blocked at this point. Partly cloudy skies will stay with us the rest of this afternoon. It'll clear up tonight around the valley. Look for lows to be in the mid-60s. Partly to mostly sunny tomorrow, way below normal high temperature of 83. And then 85 degrees expected for Saturday. Currently partly cloudy, relative humidity at 11%, 89 degrees at KJZZ at 236.
KJZZ is supported by the Phoenix Symphony, presenting Tony Award-winning Alfie Beau, performing a collection of Broadway hits from Les Miserables, The Phantom of the Opera, and more at Symphony Hall, June 4th and 5th, phoenixsymphony.org.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. NATO defense ministers say they are very concerned by the military advances being made by the self-proclaimed Islamic State, both in Iraq and Syria. Terry Schultz reports the alliance is also assessing the chance that the militants might sneak into Europe.
NATO chiefs of defense meeting in Brussels discussed possible threats from Islamist advances in Syria and Iraq, both countries that border NATO's southeastern flank along member state Turkey. But the alliance says all measures have been taken to ensure there's not a spillover effect into any NATO state. That's not quite the case with another potential threat, terrorists possibly sneaking into Europe in migrant ships. NATO's top commander, U.S. Air Force General Philip Breedlove, says most of the people on these vessels are just desperately fleeing violent homelands, but...
Yes, we believe there could be elements of extremists, so this is a problem that we need to address.
So far, though, NATO hasn't offered to get involved, either against ISIS or the migration overflow. For NPR News, I'm Terry Schultz in Brussels.
Prosecutors in Baltimore say a grand jury has indicted six city police officers in connection with the death of Freddie Gray. The officers will be arraigned in early July. Senate Democrats from the Northeast say they will fight the kinds of cuts in funding for Amtrak that have been approved by a House panel which has okayed a $1.14 billion budget for the rail service. That's less than half of what President Obama has proposed. New York Senator Charles Schumer says Amtrak's needs are all the more apparent after the recent deadly train derailment.
We need to replace bridges that are over a century old. We need to install positive train control. completely and get it up and running. We need to straighten out dangerous curves and rebuild aging tunnels.
Congressional Republicans have countered that their proposed cuts would not affect Amtrak's safety or operations funds. On Wall Street today, the Dow was up a fraction. The Nasdaq gained 19. This is NPR News.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Steve Goldstein. I'm Mark Brody. Scientists have identified a lot of potential impacts of climate change, but new research suggests there's one that the American West specifically has to prepare for: increased demand for electricity. The research, published in the journal Nature Climate Change, says warmer temperatures could put more of a strain on energy generation in the West. Matt Bartos is a research scientist in the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering at ASU and one of the authors of the paper.
Our study was intended to look at the effects of climate change on overall electricity reliability in the Western United States. So we were looking at whether increases in temperature, changes in precipitation, changes in meteorological variables like humidity might affect the ability of power plants to produce power. We found that by mid-century, so around 2050, that power generation capacity would be reduced by about 1 to 3% in an average year. And under a extreme drought event, you might see capacity reductions of 7 to 9%.
And you're talking because it theoretically will be hotter, drier, that people will need more electricity and have fewer resources with which to generate it?
Right. So in our study, we looked at the effect of climate change on electricity supply, so what's actually being produced by the power plants. And depending on what technology you're looking at, that can be affected by a number of variables. Hydroelectric power, for instance, may be constrained by reduced stream flow. And then for, you know, base load, coal, nuclear, natural gas power plants, you may experience capacity reductions both due to increased temperatures and also lack of available water to generate power.
So under that scenario, what should states or the country be doing about that? I mean, is this a matter of building more power plants, or is there something else here?
There's a number of ways that these capacity reductions could be offset. So building more power plants would be one option, maybe not the most cost-effective option, but it's certainly a possibility. There are technologies that may be able to reduce or mitigate the impacts caused by climate change. For instance, installing inlet air cooling on gas turbine facilities may be able to offset capacity reductions caused by increased temperatures. And then there's always the, you know, demand side management. So these problems are mainly going to occur during periods of peak demand due to high temperatures. People may be running their air conditioning more often. And also when temperatures are high, the transmission capacity of electrical power lines is also reduced. So, you know, figuring out how to manage demand during these peak times is probably going to be the most important.
How much of a difference do you think dealing with demand can make as opposed to maybe increasing supply?
Right. And it's difficult to assess, you know, how utilities, you know, what their ability is to actually achieve demand side management. Another option that would bridge the gap between demand and supply side would be introducing more distributed generation in terms of building scale solar energy, because solar photovoltaics are less affected by increases in temperature than, say, combustion turbines or major power plants.
How imminent of a problem do you think this is going to be? I know you said that, you know, by mid-century is where your projections were, but in the next, you know, couple years or even decade, I mean, how much of an issue are we looking at?
The year-to-year changes are fairly gradual, so it's something you'll notice over time, but they are punctuated with extreme drought events, say, which are fairly unpredictable.
Matt Bartos is a research scientist in the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering at ASU and one of the authors of the study, which has been published in the journal Nature Climate Change.
Even with an unexpectedly wet May in the Valley, doesn't it seem like we're still in a drought? Well, we are, but not quite to the level of some of our neighbors. Earlier this week, U.S. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack announced a total of $21 million in assistance would go to areas of the West that are rated in the highest categories of drought. That includes parts of California, Nevada, Oregon, and Utah. I asked Dave White, co-director of ASU's Decision Center for a Desert City, why Arizona was left out.
The Department of Agriculture, through the Farm Bill,
is allocating this $21 million to provide technical assistance and funds to farmers to increase efficiency and deal with drought in those affected states. Now, Arizona is in drought, and most of the state is either in abnormally dry conditions or moderate drought, but our state is not facing the type of severe or exceptional drought that is affecting California, and Arizona has done a very effective job of managing our way through the drought, and thus our needs are not as great as they are in some of those other states that have been allocated these funds.
Is there a sense that the planning that Arizona did could in any way work against the state as we see California again in extreme drought? Is there a case where people will then say, well, maybe Arizona can fend for itself a little better and we need to help these other states more than Arizona?
Well, fortunately, the State Department of Water Resources, along with our state's governor's office and the congressional delegation, are in constant communication with the Bureau of Reclamation, the Department of the Interior, and the other states that share in the allocation of the Colorado River water system to ensure that each of the states, their interests are protected, and that there is a regional focus on supplying adequate water to those states and in helping the states that are in dire need in time of need. And so our interests are protected, and yet we want to be in a collaborative position to support the success of the other states in our region.
What are some factors you're watching to see if the drought can get better, and at what point the drought has had such an impact that it would be even more difficult to sort of bounce back from?
So we have a couple of major concerns. One, the continuation of the current drought that has been on and off for more than 15 years in our region. If that continues, if we don't see relief in the form of potentially increased precipitation associated with the El Nino conditions that have developed, if that drought continues, as well as the materialization of impacts from climate change, including the increased temperatures and the decreased precipitation overall, the convergence of those events, a very severe, what NASA scientists have called the possibility of a so-called mega drought lasting 30 years or more, in addition with impacts from climate change, would create conditions in our region that would require significant societal investment and fairly large-scale transformations of our policy system as well as some of our management of the resources. And so those are things that we do need to be thinking very seriously about. Yes, we've done a very good job of managing our way through the drought currently, but we need to be looking toward the next 15 to 30 years and anticipating these very plausible but very challenging scenarios.
Dave White is co-director of Decision Center for a Desert City at ASU's Global Institute of Sustainability. Dave, thank you as always for the time.
Great. Thank you, Steve. Nice to talk to you.
Good afternoon. You're listening to the show on KJZZ, checking Valley traffic at this hour. All the trouble spots are on the 101 in the East Valley. A couple of accidents southbound, one at University, the other at Broadway. And northbound at Southern, a collision is blocking the on-ramp. Partly cloudy skies stand with us for the rest of the afternoon around the valley. And then clear skies for tonight with overnight lows in the mid-60s, partly to mostly sunny tomorrow. Look for a high of 83. That would be 12 degrees below normal. And then 85 degrees expected on Saturday. Currently, relative humidity is at 11%. Partly cloudy skies, 89 degrees at KJZZ at 247.
KJZZ is supported by Mayo Clinic, where teams of cancer experts work together to provide each patient with the exact care they need. Learn more at mayoclinic.org/cancer.
The Valley sees around 300 days of sunshine a year on average. Seattle, by contrast, has more than 200 days of heavy clouds each year. But new research shows that regardless of how sunny or cloudy the place you live, you're probably not reaching into the medicine cabinet for sunscreen. The study from the Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention shows around 14% of men and almost 30% of women say they regularly put sunscreen on their face and other exposed skin. Don Holman is a behavioral scientist with the CDC's Division of Cancer Prevention and Control and the study's lead author.
We have looked at sunscreen use among U.S. adults in the past, and what was unique about this study is we were specifically looking at sunscreen use on the face versus other exposed skin. So similar to findings from previous studies we've done, we found that most adults really aren't using sunscreen regularly when they're outdoors in the sun for an hour or more. But we also noticed that there are some differences in use on the face versus other exposed skin. So for example, as you might expect, especially among women, we see that some people are regularly using sunscreen on their face, but not really using it to protect other parts of their body that may be exposed.
Why do you think that is, that people would pay more attention to putting sunscreen on their face, but not their arms or legs or anything like that?
The study doesn't specifically get at that question, but we do have some ideas as to why that might be. One is that we did see that pattern mostly among women, and you'll notice that there are a lot of personal care products on the market these days that are targeting women, are for use on the face, and do have an SPF. Usually it's like an SPF of 15 or so. So we suspect that some people are just regularly using a product that happens to contain sunscreen. The other piece of this is that regular sunscreen use does help to prevent premature skin aging. So this includes wrinkles and age spots. And so you would imagine that a lot of people are very focused on reducing skin aging on the face.
Did the report look at geography at all as far as whether people in a place like Arizona, which is sunny so often, are more or less likely to use sunscreen than people in like Maine, for example?
Well, our sampling methods didn't allow us to look specifically state by state, but we did look at sunscreen use by region. And basically what we noticed is that there weren't a whole lot of regional differences in sunscreen use among women, but we saw slightly lower use of sunscreen among men in the Midwest compared to men in other regions of the U.S.
Do you think this is a matter of people like actively deciding not to put on sunscreen or just not thinking about it?
You know, I think there are a number of potential barriers to sunscreen use. Interestingly, in this recent study that we published, we found that sunscreen use was associated with household income. So we noticed that people who had lower household incomes were less likely to regularly use sunscreen. And that suggests that simply the cost of sunscreen could be a barrier for some. And then there are other issues as well. People may not see themselves at risk for skin cancer, or they may think skin cancer is not that big of a deal and, oh, it's just something that older people get that can be cut off. But in truth, skin cancer can be deadly, and it is a very serious and costly disease to treat.
How do the results that you found in this report as far as percentages of people using sunscreen compare to earlier ones that you've done?
They're pretty consistent. Sunscreen tends to be one of the more common forms of sun protection used, but the numbers we found were still consistent. I mean, it's still very low, and most Americans aren't using sunscreen regularly. So the results really weren't a surprise by any means.
Dawn Holman is a behavioral scientist with the CDC's Division of Cancer Prevention and Control. She was also the lead author on the latest study on sunscreen use in the U.S. Dawn, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
We also wanted to know if these results match what Arizona experts have seen, since several cities here are among the sunniest in the country. For that perspective, we turn to Lisa Qualley, health educator for the University of Arizona Skin Cancer Institute.
I think a lot of people use sunscreen, but I just don't think that it is at the forefront of their mind all the time. I think when people are planning on going out for a long amount of time and they're going to be outside for extended periods, they're more likely to put it on and be more serious about using sunscreen because they probably all had sunburns in their life and know that it's really a necessary thing to do. But I do believe that probably on a day-to-day basis, people aren't really thinking about using it because most people, they're not out for long periods of time on a normal, you know, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. And so they don't feel like they need it as much as on those days that they're going to be out for a long time.
So as far as people not putting on sunscreen just to sort of go on about their daily lives, do you think it's a matter of they don't think about it, they don't think they need it, or they're making a conscious decision, I'm not going to do it?
I think they don't realize how important it is. You know, if you just go out over the course of a day and you're out maybe 5 minutes here, 5 minutes there, you're getting the ultraviolet exposure from the sun, but you're probably not getting an immediate sunburn the way you would if you were going out for the whole day when people would probably remember to wear sunscreen more.
Can you envision a time where this doesn't have to be a constant message where people just know, you know, okay, you get up in the morning, you brush your teeth, you wash your face, you put on sunscreen, and then you go out and do whatever you're going to do?
I think it's possible. I think we've got a lot of work ahead of us. I think we've come a very long way. You know, if you look at what people knew 10 years ago about the relationship between the sun and skin damage and skin cancer, it's definitely gotten better. The awareness is much higher than it used to be. Sunscreens are better. They are more protective than they used to be, and people are using sunscreen more than they used to. I think one thing that needs to happen is the concept of what is beautiful has to change. You know, right now, Americans really do value a tan. They don't see it as the damage that it is. They see it as a sign of beauty. So that needs to change, and also, our fashions have to change. You know, if you look back 100 years ago at what people were wearing when they went to the beach, I mean, they were covered from head to toe. That was the style back then, and now the style is just very different. I do see a lot more kids and adults actually wearing more sun-protective bathing suits that have, you know, shirts and little shorts as opposed to just bikinis or, you know, no top. So the fashions are changing a little bit as well, which will help tremendously in protecting people from skin cancer and too much sun exposure.
Lisa Qualley is health educator for the University of Arizona Skin Cancer Institute. Lisa, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. He's Steve. I'm Mark. The show is a KJZZ original production that mixes news and features from the Valley, the region, along with national and even international news to provide a stream of engaging radio. If you've got good story ideas or want to let us know what you think, send us an email. You can find us at theshow@kjzz.org.
There are all kinds of family businesses. Some kids take over the family restaurant, others the family gardening company. One family business in Phoenix relies on cheers and booze to stay running. The show's Anika Klein has more.
Javier Escobedo and his brother Tony fight a lot. They slam each other into the ground and jump on each other's backs. Sometimes their cousins join in, and even their dad. And it's all perfectly normal. It's actually the family business.
Lucha Libre!
Lucha Libre is the Mexican style of professional wrestling involving high-flying heroes and comical villains. The losers often have to remove their masks and reveal their true identities, or sometimes shave all the hair off their heads. The Escobedo brothers, both in their 20s, have been in the business basically their whole lives. Here's Javier.
I was training since I was 4 years old. My father, he's been in this business for 38 years. He's a really big wrestler in Mexico.
The family puts on a weekly show in Mesa under the name Club Deportivo Coliseo, or CDC. They've had to move between venues across Phoenix, landing at the Arizona Event Center just a few weeks ago. The constant moving around has been tough. Javier again.
We usually get up to 700 or 800 people a week, but since we keep moving around, it's kind of hard to, you know, for them to keep track of us also.
On this particular Sunday, there are a few hundred fans cheering, booing, and teasing the wrestlers who don't always play by the rules. One wrestler takes a break by sitting in the lap of an audience member. But it's likely they already know each other. Many audience members like Aritza Mesa and Jose Sanchez are friends or family members, regulars around the ring.
I started going because my uncle is also a wrestler. And I have cousins here actually wrestling.
We've been fans since we were little. And like I have my cousins here wrestling too.
That leaves a challenge for the Escobedo brothers as they take on the family business. How to appeal to a larger audience so that they can draw in bigger crowds and book more venues. It's a problem Rockstar Wrestling Alliance in Tucson has experienced as well. The man who runs that operation is known as the Prophet. We won't disclose his real name here because, yeah, it's that important to some of these wrestlers to hide their identity. He says he's encountered plenty of venues wary of the profitability of Lucha Libre.
If I can guarantee a real good turnout and this and that, then there's no hesitation.
But that guarantee is not always there. So the Prophet tackled this issue by starting a show at the Crescent Ballroom, a music venue in downtown Phoenix. The idea is to mix a concert with the wrestling show To attract a wider audience, some wrestlers from CDC will join the next show at the Crescent on June 6th. They'll be branching out from CDC and hope to attract new fans there. And that's what it all comes down to.
Well, without the fans, there is no business. There is no Lucha Libre. There is no CDC. We don't exist.
It's the show. I'm Anika Klein.
Make sure you're with us tomorrow afternoon at 2 o'clock for the show. Steve goes hunting for scorpions. Hope, I don't know. Do you
hopefully
hope
I survive and I'll be here tomorrow.
Yeah, I don't know if we should hope you find them or not. Also, where Arizona ranks as far as affordable rental housing. Those stories and much, much more tomorrow afternoon at 2 on the show.
And if you're looking for some stuff to do tonight, you can see Christopher Titus doing stand-up comedy at the Tempe Improv starting at 8.
Also, Greg Morton will be doing musical stand-up tonight and tomorrow night at the Laugh Factory in Scottsdale.
And you better hurry to this one. I know Mark has to get in the car. You can meet the Snow Queen and the Ice Princess. That's at 3:30. Toys and Playtime Oasis in Scottsdale.
Tickets gotten. The show is produced by our senior producers Sarah Ventry and Jimmy Jenkins, with help from Bruce Drummond, Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez, Tiara Vian, and Annika Klein. Tracy Greer, Sky Shout, and Maria Springs are the digital team. Our news director is Al Macias. Our executive producer, John Hoban.
We want to hear from you. Let us know what you think. Let us know about good story ideas. The show at KJZZ.org. For Mark Brody, I'm Steve Goldstein. This is listener-supported, member-supported KJZZ-FM Phoenix and HD. All Things Considered is up next. Thanks for listening. It's 3 o'clock.